Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is June 11th, 1999, and in the fireside room this afternoon, the presenter is Bob Ekblad, and he's continuing his series on immigration, and it's entitled Welcoming the Stranger, How Christians Can Respond. And this is session 99-7.
Our last session. It's going to be on responding to immigrants in our midst and how can the church respond to to this immigration situation and current immigrants that are here in Washington State, especially. That's where I'm working, but all over the United States. I have talked in past sessions about people's very dark sort of negative images of God. What I would call street theology or popular theology. Most of the people that I deal with, immigrant people that I deal with, envision God outside of Christ. What I find is that most of the people in the jail and in the immigrant community, and actually not just the immigrant community, but most people that I would that are in members of what I'd call the underclass, which is sort of people on the fringe in our society. They have a very, very high theology, a high view of God, and a high view of providence, and a very low anthropology, or a very low view of themselves and of the human condition, okay? And that creates a huge gap, God is way up here, and they, people are way down here. At least they are, humans, they would be down here. So the typical ways that they would envision God would be, God is the one with the power, okay? So God is all powerful. God is the judge. God is a God who has all kinds of laws and who, is a law enforcement God. God does that through all law enforcement agencies that exist, whatever they might be. So, enforces laws. Except God enforces laws, much better than law enforcement agents do, because God knows our secret heart and everything. What else can we say bad? Put it here. And human beings are. People are sinful. People they're shameful. Okay, people are inadequate, unable. I have so many people that I deal with in the immigrant community that just say, I just can't follow the Ten Commandments. I just can't follow Jesus. It's just too hard. I just fail over and over. I can't stop drinking. I can't. It's just a feeling of I can't, incapacity, inability. And in addition to that, you have all the other things that come with just being from a poor peasant background in Mexico, or having grown up in the United States as a child of an immigrant family and not having finished high school, dropping out at 9th grade or 10th grade, being of a different racial, not being part of the dominant racial ethnic group, feeling like people look down at you. All of those things are part of their, make up their anthropology. Okay, so there's a huge, huge gap. Now, white folks, anyone who's white, who's not part of the underclass like themselves, because they know that there's some white folks that are drug dealers and drug users and, who might maybe even be out in the fields occasionally that might working to harvest the strawberries or whatever. But most white folks in the churches are considered sort of allied with this God, okay? If you were to put the church anywhere in this spectrum, the mainline Protestant churches would be right up here. Most immigrants see the church and God as basically, and not just the church and God, but the church and the state and God. Okay, because God works through the police, the INS, you know, the DEA, you know, all the forces, all the, because since God is all powerful, everything that happens is God's will, and if it happens to you, you must deserve it because you're bad. And that's another thing: people are sinful, or they're bad. Then people just assume that the white establishment, everyone in the white establishment, is in agreement with all of these laws. So my question to you is, and this is what we're getting to, the question of ministry. If you were God and you knew that you loved human beings and you've forgiven their sins and you've done all these things and that you'd come down as Jesus and all these and revealed yourself and walked with human beings, and but you knew that all these people saw you this way, what would you do to change people's view of yourself? What would you do to help them have a new, like right now, you're God, okay? Here we are, we're God. What would we do to help these people down here at the bottom?
You would become like
down to them.
Okay, come down to them. How would you do that?
Become like them.
Okay. Become like them? Okay, so one thing you could do is to come down. And one way to do that would be to become like them. How would you become like them? I've tried this, so I'm interested. I failed.
You would live with them,
okay,
and intermingle with them,
okay,
and
okay, now if they see you doing this, the first thing they're going to think is, it's probably some new evangelistic technique. They're trying to win our souls.
Mm-hmm.
You know, who are these guys? You know, the Mormons, they knock on the door, they go door to door, and they're followed on the, you know, closely by the Jehovah's Witnesses. It's probably the Jehovah's Witnesses that show up first, then the Mormons, and then some really hardcore fundamentalist group that leaves track under their door if they don't open the door. You know, kind of a turn or burn track. So if you come along and you decide to live, I mean, how are you going to, it gets complicated, right? Because you're dealing with, you have another church that, you have all kinds of churches that are trying to reach these people, but everyone has, you know, everyone has a different method. But you're talking about coming down, becoming like, and living with. That sounds quite different than, you know, definitely some of the groups that I've heard, I mean, that I've observed.
I know I live in Trentner, New Jersey, in this low income facility for mentally handicapped, and when I moved in there, I did not want to live there. I did not want to live among them. The place was dirty, and I didn't know there was a lot of drug addicts and alcoholics and all sorts of people living there, and I didn't want to live there. But then I decided my purpose going out there wasn't to be any better than anybody else. So then I decided for 1 year I could live there, and I got a $25 a week stipend, and I tried to live on that because they didn't have money.
Mm-hmm.
And I had the most tremendous experience.
How long did you do that for?
For a year.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
For a whole year. They didn't want me to go. They just, I was their best friend. And
so where did you move? You moved into their community?
No, I moved back to my home.
No, I mean, where did you, for that year you lived with them?
Yeah, I lived with them, and then I worked in the immigration office and started an emergency program for people with AIDS. But I'd go home and I ate one meal a day with them, and I, in the evening, you know, there was black women, like when I'd come from work, there was black women that all sat in this one room and were visiting, and I'd go in there and boy, we'd just talk, and I, you know, it was just the greatest thing I've ever done.
Oh, that's great. That's, and then you notice, what did you notice when you first started doing that? Were people suspicious of you at all?
Oh yeah, they looked and wondered who in the world I was.
So how did that change? That changed though. How did it, what did you notice changing?
Well, what I noticed was the place was so filthy, dirty,
mm-hmm,
and there was a lot of cockroaches, you know, and So I went to the board, and there was pastors on the board. And I went there and I said, you above all people know that God loves everybody. And I said, just because these people are poor doesn't mean that they have to live in such filth. So then things started to change, and all these people were just thought it was the greatest. They didn't, when they opened the garbage room, it didn't move. You know, they could bring their garbage in. Like, some of the women were frightened to bring their garbage into the garbage room because the cockroaches were so bad.
Wow. So you sort of were, served as an advocate then, uh-huh. and you got this place cleaned up?
Yeah.
Wow, that's great. So another thing you can do is live with. I like what you said, eat with.
Uh-huh.
You know, with immigrants from Central America and Mexico, especially with Mexicans, the greatest gesture of solidarity is eating with people. That is a major way to, if someone invites you to eat with them, I mean, consider it a great honor, you know, because, and if you eat with them and you make a regular habit of it, I mean, they'll invite you. They're very hospitable. If you accept their hospitality, you will win their trust. And it's interesting, there's in Greek, in the New Testament, there's one of Jesus's gestures, you know, that is oftentimes overlooked. You know, you have all the verbs of Jesus' movement towards people, like Jesus. There's three different verbs of healing, you know, therapo, therapuo, and sozo, I mean, to heal, to cure, to save, to heal. And then there's a touch, and there's a cast out. Well, there's another one, eat with, okay? There's numerous occasions when Jesus ate with tax collectors and sinners, you know, and eating with people is a gesture that for Mexicans especially is a big deal. Well, not just Mexicans, in Honduras, if we turn down someone's hospitality, having a cup of coffee, people were very offended. You know, we just felt like we thought we were better. We really weren't. It was like a test almost. Are you going to have my cup of coffee? And also eat with. And then you ended up advocating for. But your advocacy came out of lived experience, okay, right?
Mm-hmm.
All right, so that's what you're talking about is a descent, okay? And see, this is exactly what the gospel is all about. You know, people are used to hearing people from up here talk about the gospel. But people are sick of, I mean, people are tired of words, okay? These are people that have been promised, you know, things all their lives. I mean, in Mexico and in Latin America and all over the Southern Hemisphere, people are used to jeeps coming in with loudspeakers and politicians promising this and that and that and the other thing. And then they get into power and they're forgotten, people have forgotten. You know, and words are so cheap. You know, the only way that I think people are going to can be convinced of the gospel, which is that the all-powerful God, you know, comes down, is for them to be incarnated through the church. If the church is not willing to take that, to make that move down.
Sometimes, like, you know, like when we say the Lord's Prayer, our Father who art in heaven, we think he's way up there. I mean, but of course we know different.
Well, what's interesting is that earlier in Matthew it says, when you pray, don't be like the hypocrites that stand on the corners, but when you pray, go in your room mm-hmm. and shut the door and go to where your Father is who's who is in secret.
Mm-hmm.
So according to that text, the Father is right in your room. Right?
Mm-hmm.
That's so, I mean, you know, then you pray like this, our Father. You don't pray, my Father is in my room. You pray, our Father who is in heaven, because this is a universal God, right? But yeah, you should think about that. But notice the second line of the Lord's Prayer. Let your kingdom come and your will be done on earth
mm-hmm.
as it is in heaven.
Yeah.
Right? So, I mean, the very Lord's Prayer calls us into the heart of, you know, of humanity. I mean, yeah, the Lord's Prayer, I mean, it can continue. You know, every one of the Lord's Prayers, the cries of the Lord's Prayer are first plural, right? Deliver us from evil. Not just deliver me from evil. Deliver all of us, including the, you know, the underclass or whatever. Give us this day our daily bread. Our daily bread. Anyway, for me, the basis of ministry, I think the text that I think of, if I had to choose one single text, would be Philippians chapter 2. You know, which describes, it's one of the oldest hymns in the New Testament. and it describes this descent of God, which I think we're called to follow as well. I'm just going to read that. Before we talk about concrete sort of ministry possibilities, I want to sort of end with: do nothing from selfish ambition or conceit, but in humility regard others as better than yourselves. Let each of you look not to your own interests, but to the interests of others. Let the same mind be in you that was in Christ Jesus, who, though he was in the form of God, did not regard equality with God as something to be exploited, but emptied himself, taking the form of a slave, being born in human likeness and being found in human form. He humbled himself and became obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross. So here we have, you know, a description of this descent of God. And what's interesting is that the following, you know, all of the, almost all of the, in different places in the Gospels, the disciples are called servants, you know. And in Paul's writings, he describes himself as a slave. You know, here it says, taking on the form of a slave. And all of Paul's epistles begin with, Paul, I, Paul, slave of Jesus Christ. You know, so you have, you know, you can say, well, this is Jesus' downward descent, but the church, we're invited to this very same downward descent. In fact, that's how this text begins, right? Let the same mind be in you as was in Christ Jesus. So, one of the ways that, you know, for me that is critical is for me to look at my own self and my own interests, and you know, and to realize that, you know, that I'm at the top, you know, in terms of what I'm a person that has had. I grew up on Mercer Island, which is a wealthy suburb of Seattle. I've had every opportunity for, you know, to achieve the American dream, you know, and have the right ethnicity and the right, you know, sort of language and the right education, opportunities for education, the right gender, you know, everything to sort of have power, you know. And most of our churches, you know, most of our churches that are in the Presbyterian Church, and I think the Lutheran Church is the same, you know, I mean, those are my people, you know, and it's, but what I'm seeing is that people were perceived as being allied, you know, with the state, with the system. You know, we're perceived by the underclass as being the establishment, and so I think one of the implications of this downward movement is to make a clear differentiation, you know, between, you know, church and, you know, and all these other things, police, state, you know, judge. You know, we need to bring, you know, part of what we need to do is make it clear, you know, first of all for ourselves, but also clear before the people who we're trying to minister to, that we are, you know, that's not our business. You know, our business is not about law enforcement. You know, we have to know what our own vocation is and how our vocation is distinct from that of, you know, say the Border Patrol and the police and DSHS and, you know, and social service agencies, and, you know, and more than that, you know, that division or that separation is achieved, the more people are able to see also that God is with them, you know, not against them, not pursuing them, you know, not trying to incarcerate them or deport them. Does that make sense? So how do you think you could do? How do you think we could do that? Or does that seem kind of unrealistic? How do you react to that?
Well, I can tell you a little bit about how my own reacted. Once I went to Trenton, and I brought something along for a morning coffee, some baked goods from a very posh deli. Mm-hmm. And then she was telling me what it was like to eat with them. Mm-hmm. It wasn't very nice always.
Cockroaches, you know, I'd be eating and the cockroaches to run, you know. And like they had, like, it was almost like a cafeteria. It wasn't a very big one, but they had different kinds of meat and different kinds of vegetables and things. And they had these black people that were cooks, and, you know, they were, I thought they were real nice people. But when they would, I'd say, I'd take a breast. I'll take that breast of chicken there, you know. She'd take her hand and put it on my plate. And then maybe we'd have French fries. Well, she'd just put her hands right in the French fries and drop them. And I didn't know if I should eat it or what, you know, but everybody else ate, so of course I ate right with it. You know. And so it just, you know, and so I told the board, I said, you know, the diversity of people here and the things, and I said, I think they should wear gloves and wear hairnets. And it wasn't long before they wore hairnets, and they had really gone down and sprayed the kitchen or whatever they do for cockroaches. And it was just really, and the manager of that building, when I first came, he said, "Oh, honey," he said, "I'm a hugger." And I thought, oh no. But anyway, after I was at the board, that man, I was a threat to him, and he was very nice to me. But I still tried to be nice to him, but he just, you know, he wouldn't want anything I wanted. Because, see, I was supposed to go to him first, but I went to the board because this made it look bad for him, you know.
Yeah.
Oh, that was fun.
Somehow, in positions where we view ourselves as coming down, I think we also need to, at some point, come to the realization that these people give us as much as we give them. Otherwise, that our mutual humanness is what is binding us together.
Yeah, absolutely. Otherwise, so another thing you could put is receive from. Okay. You know, this is a very big deal. This is probably one of the very most important things. You know, I mean, John Vanier, who's a guy who founded a movement called L'Arche, which is a movement for mentally handicapped people. And my niece is actually a member of one of the communities. She was born with oxygen deficiency and she's 6 years old and is fed through a feeding tube and is completely, you know, like a vegetable. She's in one of these homes, and their whole objective is to treat these people as if, you know, as if they're Jesus. I mean, they try to receive from these people, and they let them give their gifts, and it's just an amazing experience to go into a large community, because you have this intentional attempt to, you know, to actually receive any kind of gift that these people, who normally are seen as just recipients of our benevolence or whatever.
I think what we've been saying is the whole mystery of acceptance of a person as they are, and not so much always connected to behavior. I've done some work with, I guess you call it underclass or white folks that didn't break out of the Appalachian poverty cycle, and they really see the church as hypocritical, you know, of insisting on behavior and then not doing that behavior themselves. Mm-hmm. And they see that so clearly, and so they, you know, aren't wanting to listen too much, because they're, you know, they're saying, well, if I was in your shoes, I'd do it right. I'm not in your shoes, I'm not doing it right. But if I was, I would. Mm-hmm. And, and hypocrite thing. And so I think it's the mystery of being a parent, you know, trying to love somebody for who they are. And as I just heard you talk about, they're willing to to receive and give and change the way they use their hair. That's do all kinds of things once they understand somebody has met them as a fellow human being. And and is willing to receive, you know, because fellow human beings will receive. And so that's a mystery of how to do that, I think, but it sure starts with the feeling you have about yourself being there, you know, that you certainly can't be there to, you know, send something down.
Absolutely.
Instead of,
so when you come down, it's coming down, it's not condescending, you know.
Right.
I mean, that's definitely not what coming down means, okay? You know, it's amazing. I had there's a woman who works in our ministry who we've taken around to lots of churches, and she's spoken, you know, when we've given presentations, and she says, you know, one time she went to a Mormon baptism because one of her friends became a Mormon, and she was invited, and she's really not attracted to the Mormons at all, but she said, I asked her what that was like, and she said, well, it's funny because when I go into mainline churches, all the churches you've taken me, oftentimes I feel like people are treating me not like I'm an equal, but they're, you know, but they're just, I feel like they're condescending to me. It's like they're, you know, they're, she feels the patronizing, you know, attitude, like she's being romanticized almost, or people are, it's hard to explain. But then she said, with the Mormons, I felt like they treated me like I was an equal. And I thought, wow, that is an indictment on the mainline churches. I'd taken her to a lot of Presbyterian Lutheran churches and United Methodist churches, and she felt like people weren't, rarely would she meet people that would come alongside her as an equal.
Yeah.
But she experienced that with the Mormons. And of course, the Mormons, they're trained so strongly in evangelism. And I think that's one of the things that their evangelism strategies has really emphasized, is really coming alongside people, and you know, and either that or it just comes out of their authentic spirituality. I don't know.
Well, as a public health nurse, if you make a call on a family in poverty and so forth, if you come in with a superior attitude that you know it all and you know how to what they need and so forth, you're just sunk. They won't even invite you in. So I found the best approach is not to say much of anything. Just if they invite you in, you know, just show that you're interested in them as people.
Exactly. We have 9 migrant labor camps in our county, and that fill up in about right now, and the people are there, and there's a couple thousand. You know, probably 5,000 people in these migrant labor camps and apartment complexes that are just seasonal farm workers. And there's all kinds of groups that have gone and tried to do ministry in the past in those places. And I know there's one Catholic group that has traditionally come in with a huge truckload of clothes, and they basically just drop the boxes in the middle of a camp. And all people kind of swarm in on the clothes and start, you know, kind of pawing through the boxes. And the people, you know, the Anglo folks are kind of hanging around and are present until basically everything's gone, and then they pick up the boxes and they leave. How do you think you'd feel if you were living, you know, if someone came into your community and dropped off a bunch of boxes, and, you know, full of clothes? And, you know, it's like that. So many church people, they want to respond and they want to, you know, clothed and naked and all this, but what they end up doing is just creating a much greater barrier between themselves and the people. You know, through coming condescending in a way.
One thing I learned a long time ago, probably about 15 years ago, and I'm even seeing it as I speak, you know, daily and as we talk. I used to work with adults with mental retardation, and a lot of people refer them to mental retarded people, but you strip, when you use that word, you strip the person of its personhood. It is a person with mental retardation. And sometimes, like even as we said, the poverty people, it kind of puts us in a division. Is people maybe with less funds, but if you use the word people or person first, then with that adject, like person with mental illness, because sometimes it stereotypes and then right away it's like, yeah, that's those people. And I think what I learned out of that is it's a person first, and then it is with less money or with mental retardation or something like that. But it's a conscious effort, because even as we speak, we're saying, you know, people with poverty. Well, there's a lot of people, rich people, we don't speak as that white person with a lot of money, you know, but we tend to say that person with poverty, and we identify, so we You know, that's just something I learned. I have to struggle with all the time. You know, people with different abilities. You know, which and it might be the political correct thing. You know, the other word is handicapped. Well, are they handicapped? I can be handicapped as a white woman in various places. You know, so
absolutely,
it's just one of those things. But,
yeah, you know, there's an attitude of, you know, when I think of like what would be a theology of this kind of ministry. You know, there's several sort of ideas that I think of. One would be the whole dimension of solidarity. It would be the first thing. And that comes from this whole claim, like in the scriptures, of, you know, my father was a wandering Aramaean, you know, kind of the Israelites were always kind of remembering back to their origins as strangers and aliens, right? You know, Abraham was a wanderer, and he traveled, and he was a stranger, right? And another thing that the Israelites were constantly called to remember was, you know, remember that you were called out of slavery, you know, out of the house of bondage. You know, you were, you know, remember sort of your origins, that you were saved out of a situation of slavery, you know, and then you became a wanderer and an alien, right? So that's, you know, solidarity has to come from just knowing, you know, being able to remember our own, you know, our own stories and our own, maybe our own, the stories of our forefathers or whatever, it's our immigrant forefathers and foremothers. The second thing would be the call throughout the scriptures from out of that basis were to welcome the foreigner. And, you know, we have this text in Genesis chapter 18 where Moses or Abraham is, you know, sitting out under his oak tree at the heat of the day, and these three strangers come and they show up, and you know, and they're the ones who, and then he welcomes them. He has a kid that he has slaughtered and cooked up for them, and some curds, and you know, he just totally does it up, right? And Hebrews refers to this, you know, in Hebrews chapter 13, you know, it talks about welcoming the stranger. I'll read it, chapter 13, verse 2. Let mutual love continue. Do not neglect to show hospitality to strangers, for by so doing, some have entertained angels without knowing it. Remember those who are in prison? It goes on, and, you know, and there's exhortations in Hebrews, but this whole idea of welcoming the stranger is, in Hebrews, is seen as tied to welcoming God. And that's exactly what happens when Abraham, you know, when Abraham is welcoming these three, you know, he invokes them as Lord. You know, he says, my Lord. He invokes, you know, he calls them by the name of God. And I think we've lost the connection of, you know, between foreign, you know, the foreign and, you know, the stranger, the alien, and God. Because our theology, in a way, has domesticated God. You know, we've put God in, you know, we've Our theology has given us a sense that of over-familiarity with God, in a way. You know, the term holy, you know, God is holy. You know, in the Presbyterian hymnal, we have a song, holy, holy, holy is the Lord God Almighty. You know, I was shocked when in my Old Testament studies to discover that the word holy is better translated as different, you know, or foreign, you know. I proposed that we changed our song to be different. Different, different, different. or, you know, strange. You know? And I think God has become so domesticated that we're no longer surprised anymore. And that's part of our boredom in our churches, and our boredom in our Bible studies is a God. Our theology has domesticated God, and we need, and that's why I love this Bible studies that Charlie's been doing, because he's been getting people to really loosen up and think creatively, and see, you know, and see things freshly, and that's. But I think our welcoming, I mean, our ministries to the stranger are an occasion for us to actually experience, you know, God's revelation. There was a prayer after the seafarer's lecture yesterday that David gave that I wrote down when he was praying. It's rare that I do that, but it expresses what I'm trying to say. He says, O God, reveal yourself to us through the uncertainty of encounters that may go anywhere. I just love that, you know, because that's, that's what this is all about. When we open ourselves, when we humble ourselves and we come down, you know, remembering in solidarity our common humanity with, you know, with these people in our midst, and when we look at them with respect as foreigners and as different people than ourselves, but as also people that might be ways that, I mean, God might reveal God's self in a new way through our encounter with these people. You know, with that, if we come into our ministry with that sort of a mystery, you know, I know that we will not go away dissatisfied. I know that we will experience revelation. I know that from personal experience. I mean, every time that I go into Skagit County Jail to do ministry, if I'm feeling like God is far away and I'm kind of feeling disappointed and discouraged, all I have to do is go down to the jail. If I'm feeling depressed about the world and how bad it's going and everything, all I have to do is go down to the jail and have a few encounters with people that, you know, very different, kind of strange people that I encounter in the jail. I almost always leave that place thinking, what else would I ever want to do with my life?
I was just going to say, this is something we can also learn from other faiths. I've gotten to know some of the people. They're building a Hindu temple in our town. And I've gotten to know some of their priests, and they have this multi-god, and, you know, it's not our theology. But they have this thing you're talking about, this tremendous reverence for me as a stranger, you know. And I started asking some of the folks, is that because they're a minority in Louisville and they're treating me that way? No, that's the way they would approach a stranger. Food and respect and a sense of holy about the other, that I'm on the receiving end of this, you know, and I'm just trying to understand it, and where's that coming from? So that's in their tradition, even though their theology isn't in our tradition. Some of that sense of the holy is.
Yeah. And see, we're made in the image of God. I mean, that's one of the major, you know, things that in Genesis, first three chapters of Genesis, that God creates the humans in God's image and likeness, right?
Yeah, and in that sense, you see, they're not selective. In other words, Christianity appears oftentimes to people to be very selective. Only certain ones can be in our group, you know. They're very accepted, and so we can learn, because we come across as being exclusive. Mm-hmm. Even though our Father wants to include the world, yet our presentation comes across as, if you qualify, you can be included. Mm-hmm. And so to hear from a poly community, you know, poly God community, something of what we're, is just fascinating to me. So I think in our relationship with other faiths, which now can happen more easily because they're coming into our communities, you know, large numbers, involve a large number of Indian people. I think we can learn from each other that way too, you know, that they bring something of that mystery. And then maybe we can witness to what this stranger has actually done among us in Jesus, which is to include us all, you know, so we can learn from each other.
Absolutely. There's a experience that I had going to this place called Ground Zero. It was a community that was resisting the Trident submarine bases in the 80s. And I took a Honduran peasant who was our co-worker. We brought him up and we traveled with him, and we spoke in lots of churches. And we went out, we were asked to speak out at Ground Zero, their community. We went out there, and there was a bunch of Buddhist monks who were building this ashram, because this was a multi-faith effort, this Ground Zero project. And when we came into the room to give our presentation, the Buddhist monks all got down and bowed. Mm-hmm. You know, I got on their knees and they bowed down to us. Mm-hmm. And it was a real gesture of humility.
Yeah.
And it just it really blew away this Honduran peasant guy, who was used to being, you know, just kind of seen as the scum of the earth in his culture. And, you know, and who felt the language gap and just, you know, just being a poor Honduran peasant, he was feeling bad about what he didn't have and his country didn't have in comparison to this rich country and everything. Here's this Buddhist monk, head shaved and everything, totally humble, and starts bowing down. And I think there's a lot we can learn from traditions like that. So That's what I understand to be this coming down and taking the form of a slave. You know, it's interesting that the Greek doesn't use a gentle word there. It's the word doulos, which means slave. You can't get any more, you know, kind of grassrootsy than that. I mean, you know, more humble place of servanthood. In our ministry in Skagit County, what we're trying to do is engage Anglo churches in ministry to the migrant community. We've recognized that we are unable to do it ourselves with our little ministry. I mean, we're completely dependent upon, kind of volunteers and other people that are stepping forward. We have a huge immigrant community in our county, and the needs are just amazing. I mean, huge, awesome needs in terms of needs for, you know, for clothing and for food and for just the main need that people have is to feel like they're welcomed and included. You know, because most of the immigrants, many of them, about half of them are undocumented, and they feel like they're always, they're always in a position where they could be picked up and deported, and they feel like outsiders. I mean, they don't have the paper. They're driving around, a lot of them, without driver's license, without insurance, and without, you know, anything, you know. And so they're very vulnerable. They're a place of real vulnerability. And so what we tried to do is bring, we've been brainstorming for the last 5 years about how to engage English-speaking church people, you know, in ministry, and help them create an environment where we will win the trust and the respect of the immigrant community, so we can do more than just be a ministry of presence. Ministry of presence is the way we describe our ministry. You know, is we want to be a quality of presence, a Christian presence, that incarnates in a way the love of Christ. You know, before these people who, you know, who have God way out there. You know.
But you know, when you do that, it's just amazing how people, once they get the sense and feel that they're instruments of God or part of God's plan for what should happen to everybody, they start feeling really different about themselves. So in a way, if you can connect them, they do receive. I mean, they receive a lot. They hear the gospel like they haven't heard it before. And so there's a lot that can happen for those churches.
Yeah, right.
They can connect them, because you just look at people differently and you hear it differently.
Right, right.
And so you start feeling different about, you know, your own sense of who you are,
right,
that God can indeed bless your efforts and that you're a part of what was intended.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of a scary thing to... So I'm just saying there's a lot of good things that can happen.
Oh, yeah, a lot of...
On the other side there, you know.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. A lot of good things. Yeah. We see the ministry as much a ministry to the church folks,
yes,
as it is a ministry to the migrants. Or, you know, and there's a danger of almost seeing it as more of a ministry to the church folks, because we have groups that want to send their youth groups up to give them an experience, mm-hmm, so that they can be trained, so that they can do real ministry somewhere else. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's always a danger, is using the migrants, you know, as kind of an experimental place,
yeah,
to get a ministry experience for some bigger trip or something. Mm-hmm. You know, so our role is to sort of... We train, we provide trainings for groups, and this summer we have 21 churches that are involved in, that are plugging in, and we have what we do is we have migrant Bible school, or we have migrant camp improvement projects, you know, where we partner local growers who have migrant camps with churches, and you know, we'll approach the growers and say, look, we recognize because of zoning and everything, you guys can't you can't rebuild your structures, and you've had a hard year, you know, and we try to give them the benefit of the doubt, and we say, listen, we have work crews that are available, we can repaint all of your housing, we can put in new mattresses, and you know, do any work that you need. If you guys can provide the materials, you know, the paint, great. If you can't, let us know, but we'd like to see, you know, if you're interested, that you guys at least provide the materials. And so we've repainted most of the migrant camps, you know, through church youth groups, and then in addition, put in basketball courts and, you know, covered picnic areas that we can use for, you know, for gatherings and just all kinds of just projects. I mean, now we're looking for projects. We have so many churches that want to be involved that we, you know, we're just bending over backwards to find projects. So there's playgrounds that are being put in, and you know, all of this is a way to, you know, to help. And you know, and the migrants see these church groups come in and do these work projects, and then in addition, we have migrant Bible schools that we organize where we train the church folks in, you know, in how to go and you know, and every single family to, you know, to sign up kids, sign up their children, and the children, usually we get the whole camp, pretty much everyone. There'll be a few people that will be distrustful, that were distrustful in the beginning, but now it's our fifth year, and some people are trusting us with their kids, and we'll put on these 1 week long, you know, evening migrant Bible schools, where they'll be singing and crafts, and you know, and then at the very last night, we have host churches that are like churches in the area that are usually smaller, and we have mission churches that are churches that come from the outside and usually have more resources, and we the host churches, you know, use their kitchen facilities, and they loan us those facilities, and maybe they'll house some of the groups that come or let them camp in there at their church, or put up the people in their houses. So the mission churches will come in and work with the host churches, and we will, at the very last day of the migrant Bible school, the church will put on, the host church and the mission church together will put on a huge fiesta, and we'll invite the whole migrant camp, everybody, to this fiesta. And when we get there, we have a service where usually I'll have asked a number of migrants to tell their stories, and then I will translate their stories to the church people. And then the church will do a formal welcoming. You know, they'll invite all of the migrant farm workers to stand, and then we'll make a statement of welcome. We'll just say, we are thankful that you are in our community, that you're harvesting these, doing this work that many of us would never want to do, that never could do, even if we wanted to, because you're skilled at, you know, hoeing and pruning and doing all these things. And then we'll give them a big round of applause, and then have this huge feed, you know. And it's just been powerful to watch, you know, watch the impact, see what that does to these migrant people. You know, their faces just, you know, I've seen just incredible emotion when these people are getting, you know, have it, the whole church and all the, you know, participants are applauding them and welcoming them.
Do you find that language is a barrier?
Language is a barrier, you know, but we have churches that have gotten so excited about this that they've had all through the year, they have Spanish classes every week.
We do, you know, at our church.
Where people are preparing, but people usually won't learn Spanish unless they have had some experience that hooks them, that excites them, so they have a reason to want to learn Spanish. So they know some people that started a relationship and they want that to increase. So one church had 25 people taking a Spanish class, you know, this summer. Another thing we do is we have an INS watch group. It's a scheduled watch, INS watch group. We have, in our area, we have raids where the INS will swoop down on these growers' operations, and they'll have like 25, 30 agents with police dogs and helicopters, and they will grab the people all the people, and they'll make them show their identification, and if they're not documented, or if they're suspected as being undocumented, they will put them all in a big paddy wagon and haul them up to this detention center and check them all out. And then within a couple days, all the ones that are illegal will be deported. But what we do is we've trained people there have been a lot of abuses, you know. Some of the agents have groped at some of the women and inappropriately, and people have been beaten up, you know. And, you know, we hear all these reports, you know, from the migrants themselves. So we trained a group of people with video cameras, and we have shirts that say INS Watch. And we have an immediate response network so that we told all the farmers and all the farm workers, you know, call us as soon as this happens. And there have been occasions where we've gone with video cameras and been present during raids, and we just say, you know, we're not here to stop your work. We say to the Border Patrol, I'm a representative of the INS Watch Group, and we're not here to stop you. We're just here to make sure no one gets hurt. We're going to be taking video footage of this. And then so there's one group that does that, and then we'll go and afterwards and interview all the people who were witnesses, and if there are any abuses, then I will immediately call the head of the Border Patrol and the head of the INS, and I'll make a complaint, and I'll tell them that this is what was reported, and then we'll make a press release, and we send the press release out to all the papers, And then we have another group that goes out to the migrant camp to see how the families are, to see if there were families that were separated, like there always are, and see if they need someone to cook for them, you know, and to provide, if they need any blankets or any kind of help. And that's kind of the family support group, right? So this has been, in organizing this, we've had many meetings where we've invited all the farm workers and all the farmers and the Border Patrol and everyone together we formally presented what we're doing to the INS and the Border Patrol, right? Mm-hmm. And we say, you know, we're going to do this because we want to see, you know, we want to see an improvement. We want to see you work. We want to hold you accountable to the highest professional standards. And when they do a good job of a raid, I will call them and praise them, even though I hate raids. But you know, they have until the laws are changed. You know, we can't expect them to not.
It's kind of a mixed bag because if they would break a law, they would come under full protection in order to be deported. If they're a felon, you know, they get all kinds of legal protection, and you know, it's hard to even do it then. I mean,
you can't do it. Yeah. Huh? Right.
I'm just saying it's really difficult to deport somebody that's broken the law if they're illegal.
Yeah.
So we made it easier for them if they would break a law than if they don't. Because you can't just deport somebody because they broke a law. I mean, that's what finally has happened. But you got to take them through a court program. You have to, and they can have every defense, and they can have reviews. And it's kind of interesting.
Yeah. I want to end with just a few slides to put more of a face on this. If that slide still works. I just have five slides, I think, or six slides, but just to give you a sense of what this is about. Anyway, this INS watch group has been, you know, the farm workers are starting to see that the church people, you know, are distinguished from the church people that work with our ministry are not allied with the INS and the Border Patrol. They're not necessarily against them. They don't have to be against them, but they recognize that their role is to be with the people, you know? And that's been a powerful witness. This is a picture of a woman whose husband was taken by the Border Patrol. I mean, taken to prison for 15 years. And, you know, there's a major need for advocacy. You know, and church people can do so much to accompany people like this woman who was suddenly, you know, 8 months pregnant when her husband was sent off to prison and had no car and no way to get to work. And she had to move out of her apartment because her husband was gone and no one to pay the rent. And we found church people who were able to equip her with a bed and with dressers, and once she did finally get into an apartment that she could afford. And there's a major place for the churches to be involved in advocacy, no doubt. And and giving people bus tickets sometimes to go to places they need to go to. This is the Border Patrol. You know, and our efforts with the Border Patrol have centered on what I just mentioned, holding them accountable and also educating the Hispanic population about what their legal rights are. You know, through our newspaper, which is a quarterly newspaper, we have every single edition. We educate people about what the laws are and what the consequences of breaking the laws are and what their legal rights are if the INS or the police or anyone shows up at their door or stops them when they're driving. We've arranged it so that the Border Patrol even helps us sometimes by sending back families. Like if there's someone that's deported, the rest of the family, we arrange trips where the whole family can be deported together with the person, you know, rather than having the family be separated. We've also arranged where the Border Patrol has released people that they were going to deport so that they could be with the back of their families, but that's much harder. The Migrant Camp Improvement Projects, are a great opportunity to bring Anglos and Hispanic people together. These are my kids, and there's a huge, there's a big work group from one of the Presbyterian churches in our county that's working side by side with a lot of the farm workers to build the basketball court. And, you know, another thing that I do is I get out in the fields with people and pick. And we've done this with, we brought in groups from Lutheran Brotherhood and different camps to come and spend a day working out the fields with the migrants. And this last year, it was really powerful. There's a group of about 40 students, high school students, that went out and worked for a whole day. And they would pick strawberries side by side with the farm workers. And when they filled up a big thing, they would hand it to the people, you know, as a gesture of support to them. And so that was that enabled some of these, you know, farm workers to make a third more money than they would have made. They couldn't double their money because these Anglos folks, students couldn't pick that fast. Or cucumbers, you know. Migrant Bible schools, you know, we have, this gives families a chance to come together, and, you know, the kids always do a presentation of all the songs that they've learned, and that's what these parents are watching. Mm-hmm. And then we have another project, which is we get farmers in our area to donate land. And we've had a migrant collective farming project. This year we have 8 acres, and we have 24 families that have joined with us to plant 8 acres of corn. And what we do is when the harvest time comes, we right before I left here to Holden, we had all these families that came together to plant the corn and the vegetables. Actually, we had a local grower that did all the plowing, and then another farmer that agreed to, for the first time, normally we plant it by hand, which is a lot of work planting 8 acres of corn by hand. But this year we got a farmer to go in and farm it and to plow or plant 7 acres with his tractor. And then we left 1 acre out, and we divided the 1 acre into 8 plots. And we had 24 families, but these families were like, sometimes related to each other. So like 3 families that were related to each other would farm, would take one collective garden plot, and another 3 families would take another. And so we have 8 little plots, but there's 24 families that are working with in that 1 acre. And then we have the 8 acres we divided up into smaller plots so that each family has a plot. Then when the harvest time comes, we go to churches, and we have churches that will let us come up and set up a fresh produce stand outside the church. And we'll bring the families and present them, you know, during a minute for mission or something in the middle of a service. And then at the end, the farm worker family will be out at their table selling the produce. And this is a way to bring the farm workers and the church people together. So each one of these families will worship in, you know, maybe 7 or 8 different churches in the fall, and have that experience of being in our churches, right? And that's another way to break down the barriers. This is our center where we have a weekly Bible study in Spanish. And one of the things that I really believe is that it's not, ministry of presence is critical for breaking down the barriers and for that, you know, for being able to have solidarity. But it's really, all it does is create the context for, you know, for the proclamation of the word, ministry of the word and ministry of sacraments, which for me are also really important and need to be included in a whole, if we're going to do a holistic ministry, you know, to these people. So we offer the sacraments, and, you know, and we have a regular Bible study every Sunday night, and everyone knows about it. And if everyone came who comes, we'd have probably 90 people, but usually we're about 15 or 20. And this, we started out, our first year, we were like 3 or 4. And, you know, for a whole year, it was pretty discouraging because there was no trust. You know, we were seen as non-Catholics, and so it was very difficult for us to win the trust. But every year, we're getting more, the trust is building more and more, and we're getting more and more people coming. And now we have a daily service of prayer every day at noon. And we're just a 15-minute prayer service. And we have, who's ever in the office, we have a storefront, so we have, that's open all morning. And we distribute clothing, you know, used clothing. And then we have a person, you know, I'm there often to help people with legal questions, and we do pastoral counseling, and, you know, that's where we publish our newspaper as well. The churches, since the Spanish language is, most people don't know Spanish, one of the main ways churches work is through actually being present with their bodies and working, you know, putting in basketball courts and, you know, or helping introduce crafts. We brought in lots of people that are artists, and this was a mask maker who came and gave a whole seminar on mask making that the kids just loved, and this guy was there for every day of a, and he made huge giant-sized puppets, and he put on a pageant for all the farm workers and invited the whole camp. This is one of the families that is selling corn and produce in a church in Oak Harbor, Washington. And this is a migrant Bible school. You know, the migrant Bible schools, most of the participants, the Anglo participants from the churches, bring their kids, and so it's a chance for their kids to have an experience, you know, a cross-cultural experience as well, playing with all the Mexican kids. And then the meal, this is Edison Lutheran Church hosting the migrant, one of the, you know, big fiesta. And our objective is to try to make some paths that are well-worn paths between the churches and the migrant camps. And it takes years and years to really make that happen, but it's happening. You know, now I'm being asked to do weddings, and I am oftentimes performing weddings in these different churches that are close to the migrant camps. Sometimes they're Lutheran churches, other times they're United Methodists. One thing we're trying to do is have a united front of you know, Protestant churches, you know, rather than having it be a Methodist or a Presbyterian or a Lutheran ministry. I mean, all those differences are a barrier to our ministry because people just don't understand Methodista, Presbyteriana. We might as well be a Mormon. They make no distinction between a Lutheran and a Mormon. Okay, it's just anything that we're not Catholics. So that's why we call our ministry Tierra Nueva, New Earth, after Isaiah 65.
And do the Roman Catholics do any? Do the Roman Catholics do any mission, or do they expect the migrants to come to them?
They expect migrants to come to them, but I think it's mainly they're just understaffed. And but they kind of have they stake their claim with the migrants. They sort of claim them as their people, since most of them are Catholic. And it's kind of unfortunate. At one point we had a very good working relationship with a priest who was a very progressive, open priest, and he would have me come and lead Bible studies. And I did a 6-week series, and we had 75 farm workers come to it. But then he died, and the new priest that came has said that Catholics have no business learning faith or scripture from Protestants. And he's a young priest who's very conservative. And so but every year there's a farm worker solidarity march where about a couple thousand people march in solidarity with all the farm workers. And we've started a service, an ecumenical worship service at the beginning of the march. And I do that with two of the main Catholic lay leaders who are Mexicans. You know, and it's an ecumenical, you know, kind of service. And so there are possibilities. It's just a slow process. So anyway, that's pretty much all I have for everybody. But I do have our newspapers, and if you don't have one of our Tierra Nueva newspapers, I encourage you to pick one up. And if you want to get it, if you want to receive it, you can just drop me a note. There's an address in the opening of the newspaper. This is our latest one, and this has a lot of information. This is the latest article, Deportations Increasing, describes the current laws and how they're impacting migrants and, well, just any immigrants of any kind, really. And I think that, you know, I'd be glad to put you on the mailing list if you want to get it. And I'm going to go grab a bunch right now before you leave.
Thank you.